My name is Randy Smith, and I worked at Looking Glass between the years of 1997 and 2000 when they shut their doors. I'm currently a creative director at a small indie studio called Tiger Style, which is co-owned and co-led with a guy named David Kalina, who I worked with at Ion Storm. And we mostly work on casual iPhone games now that carry some of Looking Glass's sophisticated design technique a little bit.
Yes, and that's exactly, so following that thread of kind of how you got what you think that technique is and what that means to you and how that evolved in your own mind and over the course of the different projects you've done and both at Looking Glass and after Looking Glass. So that's kind of, that's basically what this is about.
Great.
And so I would imagine we could just start at the beginning. What do you see as the beginning of your career in the games industry? Like, did you always want to get into it? Did you kind of fall into it? And how did you get started at Looking Glass? And what were your first projects?
Right, sure. Looking Glass really has a lot to do with my career in the games industry and how and why I got started. I had, you know, been a gamer my whole life, both video games and other game formats. And one of the really important playing experiences for me was the game System Shock, which just really felt like it captured a lot of my favorite types of moments from video games, what I felt like the medium was capable of, what it was for. I just became very involved with that experience, really loved it. As a hardcore sort of gamer focusing on what I felt like was the pinnacle of gaming at the time, this was back in 1994. And when I, you know, I went to school for computer science and I was sort of half, I was in a band and I was half sort of thinking maybe I'll be a rock star for a living, and then half thinking like, well, you know, I can always fall back on programming if that doesn't work out, because I was a pretty capable technical person and programmer. But really, I didn't want to be a programmer. I wanted to be a designer. So the band didn't work out, so I wasn't going to be a rock star. And then I graduated and I went to grad school for a year, and it was a little bit too academic and less production oriented for me. I wanted to actually work on hands-on tangible things. And so that's when I was like, well, maybe this is the time to go for it, and I'll just try to become an actual video game developer, be a programmer. And when I started looking around for who is hiring in the games industry, I was sort of compiling a giant list of all the different studios I might want to work for, and Looking Glass was at the top of that list as the studio I was most interested in. At this time, they weren't advertising any open positions in their studio, but they did have a teaser website for the project. At that time, it was just called The Dark Project. They didn't append the word thief to the title of that game yet. But it was this very evocative, poetic, visual, textured website. It was basically a piece of art on the web. And I knew the little piece of the game that I'd seen and sort of evoked from that website. And I knew that these were the guys who made System Shock. And that's why they're on the top of that list. I was really passionate about getting a job with Looking Glass. But as I said, they weren't hiring. So what I did was I somehow found the actual phone number for the phone that was on the desk of Greg LaPiccolo, who was the project director, and I cold called him, and I was sort of like, don't hang up, but I really want to work for your company, and I'm a programmer. And, you know, he was very receptive, and he was like, sure, well, you know, send us your resume, send us your materials, and I was persistent. I drove myself down for a couple different interviews. They sent me back with homework with their level editor. They wanted me to build a level and show that I had some design instincts, and I came and talked with the team. I got to tour the office. For me, it was a pleasure just to be able to, like, visit a design studio for the first time and see people who are really working on games. But it worked out. I'm not sure they're super confident in me at first, but they did give me a chance and I joined the team and things took off from there. Really early on in my career, they were like, you know, you're not such a great programmer, but you're pretty good at design. So why don't you just stop with that whole programming thing and you can be a level builder for us. And that's how I got started.
Oh, wow. That's really cool. That sounds kind of like what a lot of people imagine doing, and it's not that easy for them, you know, just kind of like, I'll cold call somebody and it'll all just kind of work out. That was really, really fortuitous for you.
It's certainly less possible today, and it's not exactly how I recommend people get started in the games industry, but at the time it was a smaller industry that was still had some connections to its sort of cottage industry roots, and Looking Glass was a very freewheeling indie studio who was open to these kind of things. And really, you know, when you're doing something that's more about principle than it is about profit, you're just going to attract a lot of like-minded people. And I think that was part of what the culture of Looking Glass was about.
So is that what year was that about? That would have been like late 96, early 97?
I think it was early 97 that I started calling Greg, and I eventually landed the job in October of 97. Mm-hmm. Like, one of the things that was interesting to me when I started working at Looking Glass, and so I get to meet and work with my video game creator heroes, you know, and so I spent a lot of time gushing about System Shock and what a great experience it was. And it was interesting to me that they had a really refined notion of what the theory that made that game work was. You know, they talked about it being haunted house set in space, and they talked about it being a space dungeon. And when I thought about those, you know, it took me a long time. I kind of took those to heart, and they didn't make sense when I heard them the first time, but I've, you know, thought about them a lot over the years, and they do make sense now. But that was something that was like very clear, I think, to that group of people, like that was what they were making. And it's just like what we were talking about, Austin and the other folks who worked on the earlier games, like the Underworld series, had experimented and tried different things and found the things that worked best and really refined the formula and then made System Shock. To them, it was very similar to Ultima Underworld. It's just that they sort of cut out the parts that didn't work as well. They really focused on developed and modified and evolved the parts that worked well. And they set it in space, which was kind of an aside, you know. Mm-hmm. But you know, the environment of Citadel Station and System Shock is not so different than the dungeons of Underworld, you know, which is a pretty cool thing to think about, how people develop theories and then apply them, and it works, you know.
Yeah, System Shock is almost kind of, I mean, it's not Underworld in reverse, but in Underworld you start at the top of a cave and kind of move down, and in System Shock you're kind of in the bottom of the space station moving up. But if you look at the two games side by side, they're almost, it's almost like a cyberpunk remake of Ultima Underworld 1, but
yeah, exactly. So for me, I mean, it's, I played System Shock as a player, not a designer. I mean, I've always had an analytical design mind, but you know, before I got involved in the games industry, it was easier for me to become immersed in the illusion and suspend my disbelief and stuff. So for me, the thing that was really important as a player experience was, first of all, the immersion, the fact that the game was really seamlessly trying to keep you in a place where you believed that you're present in the space, that there were this world that they had created for you. And there's a lot of, you know, a lot of those evolved techniques helped with that. The fact that you didn't wind up in conversation trees where you wish you could say something, but you didn't have the ability to say that. So you felt, it became clear to you that you were just a player playing a game. And instead, it's kind of like anything you saw, you felt you had an appropriate amount of interaction with. And I think that's part of the immersion. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't constantly present you with things where you're like, well, if I was really there in real life, I'd try this. And instead, it was always the case that you could kind of do what you wanted to do. Because certainly it wasn't immersion in the sense of, you know, beautiful graphics. You know, it wasn't a graphically beautiful game, even for the time. So it's interesting that immersion techniques have a lot more to do than just with the fidelity of the world. It also has to do with how the world behaves and what actions the player has available to them. And then secondarily, the thing that worked really well for me and is maybe even closer to the heart of the Looking Glass philosophy is player expression and freedom. The fact that it's not a game where they insist that you approach it in one way, and that there's always a certain amount of choice that you're making, choice that has consequences, a tactical expression you might make about how you want to deal with the challenges. And just in general, there's just always the sense that it's your game, like the phrase abdication of authorship, meaning like, we, the designers, put you in a situation in a world and we give you some tools, and it's really up to you to use those tools to deal with the situation you're in.
That sounds like a very coherent explanation of what is going on in those games, and also some of the topics that have come up previously on the podcast. So when you got to Looking Glass and started working on, I mean, is that like as clear as it is in your head now? Did you develop that clarity when you were working at Looking Glass, when you were working on Thief, or how did that all come about?
Well, I mean, I think even people who don't spend the majority of their careers thinking about this kind of stuff can have a pretty accurate instinct about it. I think that the trick is really articulating it and understanding the theory well enough to be able to apply it to different situations. But it's kind of like one of those things that might be hard to articulate, but that you know it when you're in it, you can feel it when it's done correctly. And moreover, I mean, the entire Looking Glass culture was really about these types of principles and how they were achieved. And we're a very verbal, very analytical group of people. There's a lot of articulation about our values and our techniques. And that was so handy as a junior person, you know, in a studio full of these wonderful designers, just being able to hear them think of how they speak. It was really eye-opening to me that people were that analytical, that they didn't just shoot from the hip and make great games, because you can do that too, and lots of people do it very successfully, but that these were people who stopped and thought about how, why shooting from the hip worked, so that instead of shooting from the hip, they're actually aiming, or to continue the metaphor, they're using sniper rifles, who knows.
Now, how did that manifest in a practical manner? Like, was that just kind of conversations around the office, or when you were trying to solve a practical problem, there was just a higher level of articulation in how people talked? Because Austin, when he was on the podcast, mentioned that at some point in Looking Glass, they organized a series of talks where people actually presented kind of what their philosophy of how to solve, you know, different problems as the company moved forward. And he said that those talks weren't really popular, and he thinks he did the first and the last one is what he said. And I'm just wondering, so maybe they tried a formal version, but then it just kind of was just so ingrained in the culture that he found they didn't need to do that, or?
Yeah, I can't refer to Austin's story. It sounds like something that happened slightly before my time there.
Before, yeah.
Yeah, but absolutely, yes. I think that was probably so redundant with the existing culture is why it was unnecessary. You know, it was really the case that we would constantly have these discussions. Like a design topic would come up, like, should the player be able to carry bodies, which is, you know, an important game mechanic in Thief. And somebody would, you know, it'd be a topic that we'd sort of had come up occasionally off and on. It wasn't on anybody's schedule yet, but we knew it was on the horizon for us to think about. And we would have these informal chats about it. And somebody would be saying something to somebody else, like, oh, I'm building this part of my level. And gosh, you know, if we're going to have two guards patrolling down this hallway, that means we're going to need body carrying, or else it's going to look really bad and counter immersive. So there's one of our values, right? If this other guard walks by and doesn't see him, so you're going to need to pick him up, or else it's a forced failure. Forced failure is another important, you know, design term relevant to Looking Glass's principles and design values. And so we'd started a discussion like that. Should I build my level like this? Should I have a different type of patrolling pattern, etc.? And then Mark LeBlanc would come out of his office, because he always left his office door open, so he'd be in earshot of exactly these kind of conversations, and he'd bust out with some very important piece of Glass design philosophy and apply it directly to that question. And then Tim Stelmach, whose office was adjacent to Mark's, would come out, and he would have his opinion that he would share, and we'd start to understand the structure of values and principles that were competing with each other and what was the best thing to do, and so forth. And so it was just sort of always present. And certainly on those occasions when we had, you know, design reviews where we actually, like, looked at our design documents or talked about the way we're trying to build levels or whatever, it would absolutely be a very formal, analytical conversation every time. That was the currency of contributing to discussions at Looking Glass. And if you couldn't keep up, it was really hard to participate.
So as you were working on, now, did you find yourself getting used to that quickly, or was it kind of rough at first? I'm just kind of wondering, like, because you did several levels, right, for Thief 1. That was your main contribution as a level designer, and
I was primarily a level designer in Thief 1. I did, you know, it was a pretty egalitarian culture to contribute to, so I was able to contribute in a lot of different places. Like, they didn't shut me down just because I was junior. They actually, you know, really welcomed those contributions. So that was cool. So I did more than just level design, but yeah, I definitely did level design.
So what did you do aside from level design?
Oh, geez. I contributed to the fiction quite a bit. I was one of the writers for the briefings that happened before every mission. I was kind of important for helping find Garrett's voice, both in a verbal, like, tonal, like the actual timbre of his voice, the way the voice actor delivered it, and also the writing, you know, of his voice.
So you did voice direction, or helped?
That's kind of one of the weirdest stories when I look at it in retrospect. But yes, I did voice direction on Thief, which is weird because I don't think I would be super comfortable in a studio I was directing if one of our junior folks did that. But actually, during my first interview with Greg LaPiccolo, the project director of Thief, he asked me what I thought Garrett's voice should be like, which was a kind of a weird and random question. And I had an answer, and it sounded like he and I were on the same page. And I don't know if that circulated around or what, but I do remember that got me thinking about it. And I was also writing his, you know, briefings and his dialogue with a bunch of other folks who were even more active with this. Terry Brocious, Dan Thrawn, Dorian Hart were very important writers of Garrett's voice, but I was involved. And then the voice actor, what's his name?
I actually don't know his name.
I should know his name, so it just slipped my mind at the moment. But he was coming to the studio for the first time, and I asked Eric Brocious, the audio director, if it'd be okay if I came in. And he was like, sure, that's fine. And so I was just sitting there on the sidelines at first, but then Eric was sort of like, oh, you know, do you have opinions about this or whatever? And I was like, well, yeah, you know, I was kind of thinking it should be a little bit more gruff. So then Russell was his name. So then Steven was like, oh, and he got like very, very gruff. And suddenly he was, you know, Duke Nukem. And we're like, no, not that. Not like that. It's kind of like a little bit more of a gravelly, like a voice. And then suddenly he's doing like, you know, Louis Armstrong or something. Like, no, not quite that. Like, it's a little bit more like a weary, you know, he's tired of all this stuff. And so then he's like Dopey, the dog who's like falling asleep. I'm like, no, not that kind of tired. More like world weary. And then suddenly it's like, boom, he was Garrett.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, it's like that. And then Eric kind of took over from there. And he's like, okay, I got, you know, like he sort of worked through the nuance and the delivery and all the stuff that takes an actual audio, you know, voice director to do. Sure. But yeah, I was right there helping Stephen Russell find Garrett's voice. And no one else was there but me and Eric. It's kind of like bizarre in retrospect.
That sounds so that's exactly the kind of thing that we want to hear on this podcast. Because one of the things that I'm looking for specifically is like where authorially different, and I don't have this idea that like the game has one author, but there are people who make decisions and have specific creative contributions. And I'm really interested because I love Garrett's voice and I love that character, but, you know, so I'm really interested in, so where does that come from? And this is a great answer to, and I know not just from you, but you were a significant contributing factor, it sounds like.
Yeah, I made a contribution. I mean, it comes from Stephen Russell, you know, it's his voice. It's that I was part of him finding that voice, you know, and I don't want to overstate my involvement because, of course, the fact that Brocious, the audio director, is there means that somebody is supervising and being sure that it went well. And that's why I didn't wind up with a bad voice, you know. But yeah, you know, everybody got to contribute at Looking Glass. It was very much a loosely organized group of autonomous creators who happen to be bound together by a common vision on a lot of things a lot of the time. So it's not like we're a hive mind exactly, but it really wasn't the hierarchical structure that you see in a lot of studios. It is a very comfortable and loose hierarchy to the extent
that very compatible sensibilities.
We did, and there's just sort of a certain amount of deferring. There's like a culture of deferring to people who clearly were more knowledgeable about it, and that tended to go along pretty well with people who were passionate about it. So that worked out, you know, because sometimes you'll wind up in a case where somebody really cares about something, but they're not well suited to do it. Yeah. And it wasn't like that there, you know, for the most part, especially for Thief of the Dark Project, there's just like a lot of knowing that Tim Stelmach was going to be the best at certain things. And if he had a strong opinion at the end, you would defer to him, even if you didn't understand or agree with it, you know, it was kind of like that.
Yeah. So I'm also interested in the whole, like, where the personality of the games and the characters come from. So you had an opinion about the character's voice and how it should sound. You were also writing mission dialogue, and you were also a level designer. And I imagine the connection between all those things was not arbitrary, was not trivial. I mean, the fact that you had an idea of what the level should be, what the challenges should be, what the tone should be, I mean, that affected your opinion of like how the voice acting should sound and how things should be written. And that feels very holistic to me in a way that a lot of games don't.
Yeah. And you know, I've spent parts of my career trying to understand why that worked well on Thief, or to, you know, maybe to the extent that it worked well. It did work well, that you can see some sort of like ornate, knobby, pointless baroqueness to Looking Glass games where you're like, wow, that's a lot of stuff they threw in the kitchen sink, you know, like, and Thief has a little bit of that, but compared to earlier Looking Glass games, it's a pretty streamlined game.
It's a pretty lean and mean game compared to System Shock.
Totally. And so I've tried to understand how that feat of creative direction worked so well when it was not clear all the time who had their hands on the wheel, if anyone, you know. And I think a lot of it can be attributed to, I mean, obviously there's culture and it helps a lot. And there's an open pit, a lot of discussion, a lot of concept art, and you know, we got to see the cutscenes of the game as they're emerging. Like, there's a lot of reinforcing of what we were doing, but a lot of it was that teaser website was one of the biggest pieces of influence that worked for me, because it really had a strong tone that was very authentic to the game that we shipped, and it was also our original design document just kind of hit a bunch of stuff on the head. Like, it was a very succinct way to articulate what the vision was while leaving lots of room for people to fill in the details. And that's kind of one of the most important lessons in creative direction, I think, for as somebody who's studied it and tried to accomplish it repeatedly throughout my career, is being able to say, we're making this game, and being able to empower all of your creative folks to make their own contribution to it, to own it, to believe in it, to be in alignment with it, you know, to be passionate about it, and not just for it to be your thing, but for it to be a team's thing. That's when I think it works best, and that's something that had already been established by the time I arrived at Looking Glass. We kind of just got what game we're making. I mean, it didn't hurt when Paul Neurath, who is the head of the studio, said, here's a name for the game, Thief, : The Dark Project. Why don't you call it Thief? Then people will know what it, you know, what game they're playing. And then obviously when I had my own studio and we're working on the iPhone space, I took that to heart and we named our game Spider, : something something, you know, like, here's the game you're playing.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny because I realize a lot of games I really like have that as a motif. It's like Hitman, for example, right? It's like the name of the game is actually the name of a job.
Yeah.
You know, because that implies a goal, a set of actions. It's almost like, you know, you have, in one word, you sort of explain the entire game to the player.
Yeah, and what players do is activity. And so if you have a word that's about the activity, that helps a lot.
Yeah. So if I'm to get a bit specific here about what else you did with Thief, am I right in assuming that you designed Return to the Cathedral, the level where you go back to the cathedral? And
yeah, that was the one that I most owned. You mentioned earlier I worked on a lot of missions. I mean, I was a good jack of all trades, all around designer. So I wound up contributing to a lot of missions in different capacities. There were missions on Thief that nobody really owned, and I just sort of did my part or whatever. But that was the one that I was very passionate about and spent had the strongest creative contribution to.
Okay, now okay. Here's another question. Do you really like scary levels?
I guess, like, so here's the thing. At some point I realized I was really good at it. You know, I wasn't even especially trying to make Return to Cathedral scary. I mean, I wanted it to be atmospheric and suspenseful, and there's this big sort of twist moment where you get ambushed, and I knew that would be frantic. But I wasn't trying to make it a terrifying level. I mean, and I'm going to defer a bunch of credit here to where it's due. I mean, you know, like, a lot of what's scary about that level was the original concept, which was not mine, was the audio is insanely important to scary stuff. And that was, again, Eric Barocious and the audio team. You know, the lighting, the atmosphere that comes from the lighting model works so well for scary stuff. I didn't invent the lighting model and so forth. You know, I had great tools to work with.
You didn't decide exactly what the haunts say when they're whispering as they walk around.
I don't think so. I think that was probably either Laura Baldwin or Terry Brocious or Eric, maybe.
Okay. But you're
or
the,
somebody's
you're the one who decided to put the player in a room with them in a certain configuration.
Kind of for sure. I did invent something scary, but I can't even remember what it was anymore. Like, I had an idea for a creature. It was so, like, we really had a lot of freedom in that studio. So I remember at one point I had an idea for a creature, and then it got made into a creature. And that was even on the first Thief. So by the second Thief, I had all kinds of, you know, creative potential available to me, and that sometimes worked out.
So was your role in the second Thief about the same?
No, I mean, I was still, it was only my second project in the Games of Tree. I was only like a second or third year, you know, designer. So I was still very junior, but you know, I was pretty capable, and the lead designer of that project, Tim Stelmach again, you know, trusted me a lot more to become involved, to take a little bit more of the creative, you know, control or the creative leadership.
What would you say, I mean, it sounds like you were very happy with how Thief went. Would you say the same thing about Thief 2? And was there anything in particular that you felt like improved or like expanded or was more experimental or interesting? Or
In general, I feel less happy with Thief 2. It's possible that part of the reason for that is because I was much more involved and I'm more critical of my own work, but I also feel like a bunch of the stuff didn't go quite as well. I mean, we had intended from the beginning to leverage Thief's best successes. You know, here's the thing. When you make a game the first time, especially one innovative like Thief, you basically learn how to make the game somewhere close to the end. You're like, oh, here's the game. We got it now. And so, for example, on Thief, there was a lot of emphasis on fighting and combat, which was sort of hedging their bets. You know, the studio and Eidos, the publisher, were worried that pure stealth wasn't active enough and that combat was more familiar for a first-person shooter perspective, and that was something that they should lean on a little bit more. And so they did. And that led to a bunch of missions with like monsters and zombies. And in general, people, at least the feeling we had in the studio at the time, is that people didn't respond to those as well. So when we decided to make Thief 2, we're like, aha, now we know what game this is. It should be a pure stealth game, and everything's about sneaking into houses and human opponents that you sneak around are staple, and we're going to really emphasize that and think about all the cool things we could do. I think it's easy to overcorrect. And one of the lessons I learned from Thief 2 was to be careful, not to put all your eggs in one basket, or not to go overboard in terms of focusing on a specific thing. I'm not articulating this part very well, but in general, what happened is that we, and this is partially my own doing with the limited amount of control I had on that project, because I was really, the whole studio, but me in particular, were really emphasizing the idea that we should do the breaking into domestic places type of gameplay, and that was really a strong emphasis. And that designing the best possible stealth missions was more important than story or how they're getting it woven together, and we would be able to solve that later. So it's very much a bottom-up model of design, in the sense that, like, here's the low-level thing that we want to create, and we'll worry about how it all weaves together later.
I'm actually quite happy you said that, because I think Thief 2 is a brilliant game, but I feel like I get in arguments with other Thief fans when I'm like, well, I like the Dark Project. I like the first game because I like the excitement of unexpectedness, the kind of grab bag feeling, the kind of like, oh, this level's Indiana Jones. Oh, this level's totally different. And I really like that aspect about the original game. And Thief 2 is impeccably designed. And but it's a more kind of on one, it's more like a variation on one theme.
I totally agree with you. It's very focused on its one thing. And the interesting thing about the grab bag is, it's like the two games, or the three games if you want to include Deadly Shadows. Like, they all had slightly different perspectives on who Garrett was. And in the first game, Garrett does feel like sometimes he's a boxer who'll slug it out with you. A lot of times, obviously, he's a thief who sneaks around. And sometimes he's Indiana Jones the adventurer. But he's always like a little greedy, stealing everything he can get his hands on. And there's kind of like an interesting tone to that. Whereas in the second game, he feels a lot less empowered, and he's really like this sneaky guy in the shadows all the time, which on the surface of it sounds like the better decision, because the name of the game is Thief, and that's the fantasy that we're selling, and we would like to provide that as much as possible. But it does get a little tiresome. I mean, there's parts of that activity of sneaking and running and hiding that are draining, and we didn't do a good job sort of providing relief for the player. And so even though on the surface of it, zombie missions are bad in a thief game, on the other hand, it's like, well, it's a nice aspect of relief where, like, now you're just engaged in this other activity.
I have to say, I really liked. I'm also a fan of horror games, but I really liked the zombie missions in the first game. And I also kind of, you can tell me if I'm right or wrong about this, but I also tend to disagree with people that those missions kind of omit stealth, because, I mean, don't all the creatures have
Yeah, all creatures have stealth models.
They all have like perception systems that you can manipulate.
Yeah, totally. And
So
so they
why?
were, I mean, they were a little bit clunky in the zombies by design,
Yeah,
obviously.
that makes sense. I mean, they're zombies, so who cares? I mean, that's the way I took it. It's like, I don't expect them to function perfectly because they're kind of broken. I don't know. I mean, I never had a problem with any of that stuff. I always loved it.
In retrospect, I'm not sure why we did.
Were you
Other
listening to the fan base? Was it like a message board kind of a thing? Because there were a lot of vocal fans, I think. Because I remember fans at the time a lot were like really complaining about the zombie levels, and I just thought that they sort of weren't giving them a chance, or were kind of having a knee-jerk reaction to them.
It's possible if I went back and played the games again now, I would understand a little better. It's possible we just didn't design those experiences as well. I mean, Looking Glass is very much about economy, meaning that you make certain systems as good as they can be, but also as flexible as you can be, so you can reuse them in a lot of different ways. And there's a lot of resistance to doing something completely different or new. Like, there's never going to be, the kart racer in the middle of a thief game, even if that was totally appropriate, just because we don't do whole other systems that we only use once, that
Sure,
kind of thing. So it's possible that we just didn't do as good of a job on those missions. Like, the fact that we're trying to do some combat and some adventure, like, the combat model just wasn't that great, But I'm not sure that greatness is the most important criteria, as opposed to the overall pacing and tone of experiences. And just having like a variation on stealth that's sneaking around from kind of stupid, undead creatures. Maybe that's good enough. Maybe that's cool.
Well, there was also and this may be an interesting segue, but I also thought that the in the first game there was a bunch of There was some crazy stuff. Like at the end, there was a mission where like you were in a disguise and like it had this whole, it like inverted a lot of the rules. Like you had to stay in people's sight and all this kind of stuff. And
oh yeah, it sounds familiar.
There was a lot. It was called Undercover. Was the name
right.
of the mission.
Was, like, wait, that was the first Thief the Dark Project, wasn't it?
Yeah, that wasn't. Yeah, that was in Thief the Dark Project. But I remember it was kind of like right up until the end of the game, it was kind of like, what? I'm going to do what? You know, kind of.
Yeah. Really, you know what's interesting about how we do things differently today is that's the kind of idea that comes out of theory, you know, like that you're like, here, you know, here's a game where most of the time you're supposed to drive around and avoid hitting pedestrians, but you know, this one level where you invert that and you hit them is really fun too, and this is a good way to provide variety. So if we're making a game that's all about sneaking, we should have a, you know, at least one mission that's the anti-sneak mission or whatever. And so we just put that on the schedule and executed on it. And I'm not sure how well it turned out. I think that's one of the missions I played the least in the first game, you know, because I wanted to play testing other things more often. Hopefully it did work out well, but it's also the kind of thing like today you wouldn't commit all those resources to it until you prototyped it first. Like very early on, you would prototype and make sure that that concept could work. I feel like that happened less often in Looking Glass, that we would check to make sure ideas were good as opposed to just like make them and hope that they're good and then tune them after, you know?
Yeah. For what it's worth, it worked for me, but
great.
I'm definitely a big fanboy of the original game.
That was a Dorian Hart mission and he's a very capable designer. So it doesn't surprise me that came out good.
No. I mean, I have no complaints. I thought it was great.
Cool.
So this is interesting though. So you've got this very clear approach to design, and for you it was manifested within one series, right? It was Thief and Thief 2. And then I was wondering if you'd talk a bit about how all that got transferred to Ironstorm when you guys Looking Glass got closed, and then Ironstorm picked up the property, and there were some people who went over, and you were one of them. The story's a little unclear to me. I'm just wondering how that all came down.
Well, on a pragmatic level, yeah. I mean, we shipped Thief 2. I think somewhere in there we also shipped Thief Gold. I can't remember which order they came in.
I think Thief Gold was right before Thief 2.
Yeah, probably. And then I think we were actually working on Thief 2 Gold, which is going to have multiplayer. It was, yeah. Actually, you know, one of my contributions, so I used to make contributions like Garrett's voice acting, which actually stuck, even though I was a very junior person, which was cool. One of my other contributions, I wrote a design document, and a lot of this stuff is very, like, you know, unsolicited. I would just send emails to the team and be like, here's ideas, and sometimes it would go well. And I sent a whole design document about the multiplayer design of Thief, which had been mentioned in the original design document, but very thinly, and I had a lot of really strong multiplayer suggestions and ideas. And that was one that did not get received very well because the programmers, you know, understood and the producers understood the role of multiplayer in a production, how likely it is to get cut, how expensive it is, how difficult it is to debug and design and produce. So they were basically like, yeah, we don't know, but we don't like your ideas either. So they're also pretty happy to tell you when that you weren't in alignment with the team. But yes, Thief 2 Gold had a multiplayer version that was prototypes and you could play it. And we used to run around blackjacking each other.
Wow.
It was sort of an early stealth multiplayer experience. I don't want to go so far to call it a game.
That was a long. It's kind of funny because now there's like Assassin's Creed Brotherhood, and there was the I think like one of the first. I mean, there's Metal Gear Online, but I think one of the first was the Splinter Cell in the second Splinter Cell game. I think that was there was a multiplayer mode in that. But this really predates a lot of that.
Oh yeah, it was. I guess it was 99 or 2000. I can't remember which year. And a lot of people tried to revive it and get it. You know. People are always trying to find the Looking Glass code and assets and try to rebuild.
Well, the fan community is like absurdly active.
Isn't that weird? Yeah.
Mod missions and stuff like that. There was this guy who did a keeper mission where you were in the keeper place or whatever, and there were other keepers and they were invisible. I remember that was a fan mission.
Oh yeah, that was really good.
Blew me away. Yeah.
I think that didn't that come out while we were working on Thief 3, so we were like, geez, this guy is, you know, we had considered that exact idea. So that's a cheap prototype for you. You can just play a fan mission.
Yeah, no, I remember. Actually, to be perfectly honest, I remember because I had played that fan mission, that was one of my and I actually quite liked Deadly Shadows, but that was one of my disappointments with it because I remember, you know, the whole thing of like, oh, now you're going against the keepers. And I was thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to be looking at shadows and I'm not going to be able to see them. And it sounds like that was something that was planned but not implemented in the final game.
I, you know, and as the project director of Thief 3, you would hope that I could answer this more concretely. But I can't remember what we planned or what we shipped exactly.
Were you, I mean, this is getting a little bit ahead of where we were, but I mean, were you gone by the time it actually shipped? Deadly Shadows?
At the very end, yeah. I was out a few months before it shipped.
Yeah, but I mean, it was sort of like done-ish, right, by the time you were...
I think there are some pretty important changes, both to fiction and tuning and so forth, that happened after I was gone, but I don't even know what they were for sure.
Okay.
I've heard rumors.
do you have any insights on how the... because people talk about the relationship between Looking Glass and Ion Storm, and also right. the connection that both of the companies had with Origin.
Yeah, I was gonna answer that question. So right, we were working on all this Thief stuff had shipped, and there was a tone of worry in the studio because we were out of money and so forth. And Terry Brocious, who's a writer and designer on the earlier parts of the Thief series, also the voice of Shodan and Victoria from the Thief series, she and I were like co-assigned the lead design position on Thief 3 when I was at Looking Glass. And so we started working on that for a couple months, and then we got shut down, right? So
pre-production had started on Thief 3 at Looking Glass at the time that it was shut down.
Pre-production is a very strong word. I would say that Terry and I hung out and we had conversations.
Okay.
And then there was like a little, like there's like a board of directors that we would present to, like all of sort of the people with the most pedigree who are still at Looking Glass, who would sort of evaluate our ideas. But yeah, then we got shut down. So I was convinced the day that we shut down that there wouldn't be a Thief 3, because I was still didn't have enough, experience in the industry to realize there'd be a Thief 3 and a Thief 4 and so forth, because it had been a pretty successful initial franchise with some good potential. But right, and then like almost the next thing that happened to me was that I went to interview at Ion Storm with Warren Spector, Texas, and he said, I was just kind of worried that it was going to be a bunch of steps back, and I was also worried that 4 years on the Thief or 3 years on the Thief series is enough, and I should move on to a different product. You know, I wanted to work on different stuff. I remember at one point Warren sort of hinted that if I was ready to take a step up, then I would, you know, that would be cool, or I don't remember exactly what he said. And it turned out he offered me the project director job. So I had never even been a lead designer before, and I was being offered the chance to be the director of the entire project. So that sort of overcame my hesitation about the idea of working on the same game for a third time. And also I was pretty excited to move and live in Austin, Texas. So that's why I took that job. And I got active in trying to bring people over, you know, as pretty close with a bunch of my fellow developers. And so Emil Pagliarulo came over, who later went on to be the project director, or sorry, the lead designer of Fallout 3, who's now, I think, the lead studio writer for all of Bethesda. Chris Carollo came over of his own accord. I had nothing to do with it. He's an extremely competent programmer designer from the Looking Glass School. He started almost the same week as I did at Looking Glass, I think. And so there's just basically, we transferred over. I wound up working with Laura Baldwin, Terry Brocious again, a bunch of people who had been at the Looking Glass studio, sometimes on other projects, like Nathan Blaisdell, who just shipped Epic Mickey with Warren, came over from the Looking Glass School and joined our team. Lots of people just kind of came over to help out. So there's a lot of the mentality sort of transferring from the Looking Glass Cambridge, Massachusetts direction. And at the same time, you know, they had just shipped Ion Storm shortly, or not Ion Storm, sorry, Deus Ex shortly before, and they had their own studio culture, which is in a lot of ways very similar. You know, they had a lot of similar ideas. It inherited a little bit more from Ultima, is a little bit more of a shooter culture. It had a lot of, there's a certain Austin development mentality that they had as well, but it was, you know, it was very compatible. So we had these sort of two sibling studios merging.
So you were given, you say project, was it project director or?
Yep, project director.
Project director on now, was it called Thief 3 at the time? And then there was some wrangling with like the IP, and then it became Deadly Shadows because they didn't want to alienate new players. Or
yeah, pretty much. There's a marketing theory about it. So you're not supposed to put 3 on things because games like Fallout 3 and Grand Theft Auto 3 don't sell. So you have to omit the 3 and put a colon. And
or Final Fantasy 7, which, you know, not a lot of people, but yeah.
Yeah, I'm not a marketing person, so I don't mean to be too snide about that decision. It did make a big difference to me, and for all I know, it helped.
Well, that's, and I think like the like install directory is still called Thief 3, I think.
It probably is.
Those are the hints. But yeah, the This is kind of funny though, because I remember at some point in was Deadly Shadows also the original title for it, or is he, do you not remember that, or
I think a marketing person came up with that because they
doesn't
wanted
really
to
sound like it.
push the violence a little more. I mean, I sort of, as as the project director, one of the things I really wanted to accomplish with that game was to push the stealth angle even further. And like, Thief 1 and Thief 2, I was happy to be a part of, in part because you had violence available to you, but that wasn't your only means of conflict resolution, And I really liked the fact that we could have this tense and exciting action game, partially action game, obviously. It's not the all-time most white knuckle action game, but that didn't always have to be end with, you killing somebody. But you couldn't get through Thief 1 and Thief 2 without doing some killing. I think we actually, like, there was a mission objective to kill somebody at some point, right? So.
Well, I actually think that's totally untrue, because if you pl well, I mean, if you play those games on the highest difficulty mode, they actually don't let you kill anybody, even guards, like literally nobody. I mean, so I don't think you.
So it is true on sort of the margins of the experience, sort of like the edge cases. I was trying to push that further towards the center of our player base, and like I wanted to make it possible for just a casual, not that there are any casual players in the Thief series, but like the average Thief player, if they chose to approach the game that way, that they had a lot of potential and could get through the game beginning to end without killing anybody. I think I also wanted them not to have to knock anybody out, not to have to be seen. Like you could ghost your way through the entire
Wow.
game. Like we had some pretty significant,
They are really hardcore. Ghosting is like the most hardcore thing I can imagine, actually.
right. So I was approaching the direction of the game with this perspective of like, wow, like we should provide this experience. Like no one would dream of shipping a Quake game where you couldn't kill everything you saw. Why should we ship a Thief game where you absolutely have to be seen, And Eidos was kind of coming from a different direction because they really wanted this franchise to be successful financially, and they wanted to push sort of violent conflict resolution, which is understandable in a lot of ways because it's, very dramatic and very clear resolution and has all these other power fantasy advantages. So I think that's where the subtitle came from. It's like we were making this game that was like less violent than they wanted to be, and they really wanted to emphasize the fact that sure, you can get through the game without killing anybody, but you can really get through the game and kill a lot of people if you want,
Like, we're not saying you have to, but if you want to,
like
it's there
yeah,
for you.
and in fairness, that's how a lot of people play, and that's fine. We support that.
I know that, like, what would you say are the biggest differences from you on the inside looking out, design-wise? Like, is there something that really makes that more of an Ion Storm game than a Looking Glass game, but even though it's still a Thief game to you, or how is there anything you want to say about that?
Oh, geez. I mean, in a lot of ways, I look at it as, I'm trying to make sure I say this appropriately. I kind of look at it as a Randy Smith game, and I don't mean that in a necessarily a complimentary way. Like I feel like I was really keen to push a lot of stuff into the game. Like we had on the surface, we talked about making it, making it more casual, accessible, making it better for the console and stuff. But I took a stab at that, really. We were trying. I was both the designer and the project director for most of the project. We really tried to redesign the control scheme and all this stuff. But in a lot of ways, it was like, if not lip service, it was certainly something I didn't have the right mentality or capabilities to do at the time. There were people on the team who had done more console work, and such as Ian, who is the lead programmer, who were really, trying to pushing to simplify things, eliminate things, make things more simple in the way console markets did. But I was really loath to give up some of the Looking Glass staples. Like, for example, the fact that you can save anywhere is something that we push really hard to maintain. And there's a lot of work that goes along with, technical work of remembering the state of every object in the world and being able to reload it back up. That's kind of a complicated technical process. And if you pull like a Metroid style solution instead, where there's just like certain spots where you're allowed to save, it simplifies the technical problem. And it's not the worst thing for design. Like you can work that into a good design. But I was very committed to some of Looking Glass's principles of immersion and stuff. And so I was resistant to some of this kind of stuff. But at the same time, I wanted the game to get bigger. Like I had the vision of it being more of an open city game where you could wander around and rob any building. So I was really trying to push for that.
Well, and that is in the game.
Absolutely. And when I say it's a Randy Smith game, there's plenty of other people who agreed with some of these ideas and liked it and wanted it to happen. I mean, Warren, among others, if not rubber stamping those types of decisions, certainly was aware of them and didn't block them, So I don't think full responsibility. But I guess one of the things I'm trying to say is that it kind of got a little blown out of proportion. We were trying to expand the design in every direction, And also in my mind, I'm very critical of my own work, by the way.
Oh, that's
right.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, we're also, you know, not especially keeping the focus on the immersive part. Like, we wanted to make a big immersive world that looked beautiful and felt alive, but there's sort of this tone of plausibility to all your actions. Is kind of what you alluded to earlier in the Austin Grossman reference, of making sure the only actions available to the player are the ones that make sense, where they have an appropriate degree of freedom. And we were definitely providing lots and lots of interactions that, you know, you as Garrett didn't necessarily have all the control that you might have wanted to have.
Now there were civilians. There were, it wasn't like literally everybody was somebody you had to steal from. It's like there were shops, and there was kind of like more of like, I'm sort of on the street, and I'm not really a thief.
Exactly. More economic persistence, more sort of politicking with the keepers and the other factions. Like, we made a faction game, or attempted to make a faction game. We made an open city game, or attempted to make an open city game. We expanded the amount of power-ups you could have, with an emphasis on some what I call technical design, not in the sense of designing software, but in the sense of, you know, manipulating the game mechanics to accomplish certain sort of theoretical goals. You know, for example, in Thief and Thief 2, you can flash bomb people, and then that way they're blind for a moment, and that's a good way for you to get away from being caught. Mm-hmm. But in practice, you can also, they're also vulnerable to the blackjack. And that sort of like eliminated the function of the flash bomb, because it was never optimal to flash bomb somebody and then run away. It was always optimal to flash bomb somebody and knock them out, which meant we didn't actually have a tool that got you out of trouble and kept the action going. So like, what I wanted for Thief 3, and a bunch of other people wanted this, was like, if you got caught, there was a way to get away and feel like you had reset conditions and recovered from your partial failure, and then you could keep playing. That didn't involve knocking somebody out. So we tried to retune the flash bomb. You know, they were just doing all these different things on all these axes. And it was hard to hold them all down and make a great game at the same time and retain the tone and believability and immersion and all this other stuff that was part of the goals as well.
So how do you feel about the final game in terms of those things? When you say we tried to do those things, or...
I guess I'm probably too close to it to be one who's appropriate to evaluate. Like, my sense looking, I haven't really dug into this part of my brain. You know, I think my sense is there was a bunch of good goals. If I was to do it again, I would have tried to provide better, cleaner, creative leadership, empowered more people to make their own decisions. Which is something I wasn't very good at the time. And I would have stripped out a bunch of stuff and really just kind of focused down. Like, we just basically bloated the feature list. And I would have taken a harder look at that and prototyped more stuff earlier and made sure we were committed to an appropriate set of features that we could really get right. And that's a lesson I've taken forward in my career. That's definitely the way I design now. But at the time, that wasn't the deal.
Yeah,
but then again, when I look at the reviews and the ratings and stuff, it looks like the game did very well and people really liked it. And I'm excited to play it someday and see how I like it. I've started before, but I have to update my Xbox or whatever. It didn't happen. But you know, I think it went well. It's just I certainly am very critical of my contributions to that project and think it would have been better if I had been a more seasoned developer by then.
Yeah, I have to say that, you know, for what it's worth, I definitely enjoyed it. I got through to the end, and I remember actually liking also how the story reached a resolution. Like, I actually thought it was like a good... It's always hard to write like the second sequel, like the third part of a trilogy. And I actually quite like the ending.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, that was stuff I think that Terry and I, among other people, like really collaborated on and had some passionate beliefs about.
Am I so the way that I read the ending, I don't know if this makes sense to you, but like it seemed like there was some sort of like final irony where like Garrett thinks he's not a keeper because he really is just selfish, but really the kind of final irony at the end is by trying to be selfish as possible, he's actually ironically the only person who's behaving like a proper keeper.
That sounds right. Yeah, that's a good read.
And that's definitely how it's kind of funny, because when I first finished the game, I remember kind of not quite understanding it. But then I remember when I had this kind of aha moment where I was like, oh, and then I remember like playing the last level again and then really kind of get it when I began to see the story in that way, then it really made sense to me. And I know people who really were like, oh man, Thief 2 had this cliffhanger. I'm like, well, you should really play Deadly Shadows, because it's got a really satisfying narrative resolution in terms of the character psychology. And
yeah, I, you I know, really it, liked it. There's a lot we had to do at the end of the game. Like, there was, so first of all, in some aspects, Thief One is about the pagans going crazy and being the force that you had to contend with, and so Garrett restores balance. And then the second game, it's the hammers are going crazy and they're a force to contend with, so Garrett defeats them and restores the balance. And so then coming to Thief Three is obviously going to be the keepers. And so when you think about the force who's trying to maintain the balance being the force that you have to contend with because they're upsetting the balance, that was sort of like a little, story gymnastics problem to try to understand not just how that would enact itself in the game, but also like what the metaphorical meaning and interpretations of that were. What were we really trying to say about the keepers? And then moreover, like Garrett is this anti-hero character who is always reluctantly dragged into his responsibilities. And he always ends the first two games being like, haha, I did my job. Now you guys have to leave me alone. Like pretending that the whole time the only reason he was involved is because he just wants to be left alone, right? But it's not hard to read into how, that was delivered in the game to understand that Garrett there's more to Garrett than that. Like he's involved for other reasons as well. So we had to sort of bring that to a satisfying conclusion that was sort of like Garrett coming to terms with the fact that he is this important person who is involved, who is doing these deeds that are good or at least involved, in some capacity, but also not be disingenuous to the character we'd built up over the years, of this anti-hero who's like gruff and kind of a pain in the butt and did everything for himself. So we were really working hard to wrap up the metaphors, leave the world in a state that's different than we found it, leave Garrett in a state that's different than how we found him, but without discrediting any of what had come before.
I really, yeah, and I mean, it worked for me. I mean, I really liked it, and I thought that it. I mean, it's the kind of thoughtful resolution that you often don't get, especially in video games. And it was really nice, and I think it also kind of drove home the kind of, I think, without tooting its own horn, without kind of shoving it in your face, kind of fairly complicated moral universe of that series. Because the point of the first game isn't exactly that the trickster is evil. I mean, it's just kind of like it's almost just kind of like the kind of like order, chaos, and balance kind
Yeah,
of.
there's just different forces who are fighting, and it's better if neither of them wins. It's kind of the vibe.
Oh yeah, and I mean, I have no idea exactly who's involved in the fourth game, but it'll be interesting to see if they, because three actually had this very nice resolution, and I have no idea if they're just gonna kind of forget that.
Yeah, we didn't really make it easy to jump back into that story.
Yeah,
So
you actually wrapped it up.
exactly. Well, I kind of did that on purpose. Like, I sort of wanted. You like I wanted the person who was going to deal with the Thief series next to have to make up their own thing. I wanted to make it. I wanted to fill our canvas so that you would have to start with a blank canvas.
Sure. Well, yeah, we'll see.
There's plenty of stories you could tell in that world. I'm sure those guys are going to do something really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I recognize all the stuff that you guys were trying to do in the game, and I do agree with you. Just from my own, I don't want to speak for all fans, but just from my own point of view. I mean, there's a lot of ideas in there. I know that at one point, you've got the mission structure of the original games is sort of intact, but then you kind of use the city to like get from mission to mission, and then but you can even get like arrested and sent to jail, and then it's like kind of like this whole other thing that happens in the game, and
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I'm proud of is how well we connected some stuff together. Like, we knew that every decision like that needed to have a reason. It wasn't just to be cool, but that somehow we could leverage that to do something kind of new or at least good, like high value for the player. Or that, there's a reason that the city existed. Like, it was a place where you harvested a certain type of resource. It was a place where you could explore and discover important side quests. It's kind of like a It's not like that those ideas didn't come from a game like Zelda. Like there's a lot of common design that you'll see, but we didn't throw things in just to throw them in. Like we definitely wanted it to be part of the overall experience. So, like as I'm riffing off this because you said something about getting thrown in jail. It's not only the case that you get thrown in jail, but then you can escape from jail, and it's actually kind of an important piece of the story that happens. So we're sort of betting that most players will get thrown in jail. If I remember correctly, if you don't do that because you're just too good or you reload before you go to jail or whatever. Then you're kind of instructed to at some point, like that you become aware of the fact that something good is in jail, and the best way to get there is by getting thrown in jail.
Really? I didn't
I feel
I
like
think
that's true.
I think it happened to me by accident, so I never
Yeah,
encountered
that was
that.
the intent, but that's the whole thing. It's like we wanted you to have this experience that you thought would be over, but then you get to keep playing, and it turns out there's something relevant, you know. That's the way things work in movies. There's like twists and turns in the story, and then turns out that was a good thing that it happened, you know. And we're trying to sort of borrow some of that, but that wasn't entirely authored by us. That would happen in context for the
Huh.
player.
It's almost like, oh yeah, that's actually, yeah, I didn't know that. That's actually quite interesting. Just this is just like a totally random question, but there's some like really messed up stuff in that game, like the witch woman and like who takes people's skin off and all this,
Gamal, yeah.
like really really nasty stuff. And I mean, it's really evocative too. And there's definitely talking about the kind of the some of the strong horror vibes of the first game,
Yeah.
and then it kind
Well,
of and then the third game brings that back like really strong. And I'm wondering if
right.
that's.
And so that's actually a continuation of the question you asked earlier. Like, I was happy to work on Return to the Cathedral. I didn't have a passion for horror or scary stuff. But then after that, when the response was really strong, I mean, it was named like the scariest mission of all time by PC Gamer UK. And I was actually interviewed by this guy, Kieran Gillen, who became a friend, about that mission and what the theory behind it was. And so I, you know, kind of on the spot developed a theory for how it worked. And then going into Thief 3, I was like, we should apply that theory. Like, we should make the scariest mission of all time that can totally, you know, knock Return to Cathedral off the charts. And so we set out with that explicit goal. And then there was a designer who joined the team in particular because he was really interested in that type of experience. And he and I wound up collaborating on what became the Shalebridge Cradle. And that designer is Jordan Thomas, who went on to be the lead of Jordan Thomas went on to be the lead for BioShock 2 and played a very important creative role that I'm not sure exactly what the title was in BioShock 1 as well. Like he's that guy, right? And so he joined the Thief 3 team and wanted to collaborate with me on this idea I had for like scariest mission of all time that would outshine Return to Cathedral. So that was a really interesting bit of applied theory in my career, at least. Jordan really deserves the credit for like doing all the implementation and a lot of the low level design on that. But he and I collaborated on kind of some of the high level beats for that mission. But yeah, I mean, he and I sort of had a passion at that point to make things really scary. I'm pretty sure that the idea of an evil witch who steals children's skin was one of Terry Brocious's, because she has a really dark streak, and she and I really like to get on a roll where we're exploring those dark streaks together, you know?
It was really scary, I have to say. It was really, really
Great.
scary.
Well, we really worked hard to make that scary. We really like spent time understanding why experiences were scary or not. We watched horror movies and deconstructed them. We actually went on a field trip to an abandoned asylum, to sort of absorb the vibe, all kinds of stuff. Like, we really worked
Where
on
was
making it
that? What
scary.
asylum did you go to?
In Austin, Texas. It's a lot less scary than it
Oh,
sounds.
okay.
It
Well, so
kind of
you're
looked.
saying that the Danvers State Mental Institution was
Was a big influence, yeah.
a big one up here. The Return of the Cathedral and the Cradle actually have some like really sort of obvious structural similarities too. Because I remember you kind of go in and then like I think like the first thing you have to do in both of them is like go to the attic or go to the basement to like turn something on to like access the second part of the level where there's like this big open set of quests you have to do. And I'm wondering when you talk about beats and some of that specific stuff, like is that part of like the structure that you wanted to replicate or?
No, I mean, it was really a more abstract theory about boundaries. The idea that the best we know, one of the theories we were working with is a great way to scare players in a video game is you tell them about a place that, you know, they shouldn't go because it's too dangerous and too, like, they're already in a dangerous and scary place. And you're like, and by the way, there's this other place that's way more dangerous and scary, but don't worry, you're not going to have to go there. And then you rearrange things so that you basically force them to go there. You know, like, and then they have to make the decision for themselves that that's the only thing they can possibly do to get themselves out of this dire situation they're in. And that was kind of one of the big things that we're like using in the Shalebridge Cradle. If there's structural similarities in terms of the quest structure, it's probably just because we're trying to move people around the space. Like, oh, now you have to tag this location, then go tag that location. It's part of the reason for that is we want you to understand where you are and get a sense of the meaning of this space so that we can scare you with it. But yeah, I mean, a lot of the theory is about the idea that there's these multiple layers of danger. And so as a player, when you think you can put your back to a wall and be safe, like we take that wall away, you know, like then you realize you were standing in open space all along.
It definitely feels like a set piece. Like it definitely feels like the big, kind of like the big mission in the game. Also because of the plot in relation to it. I think at the point that happens in the plot, like Garrett has no idea what's going on. It's just like he's just like I have no idea what's going on. Something horrible is happening, and the only thing I know is that it has to do with this horrible place.
Yeah, that was kind of the vibe, yeah.
Yeah, and the whole plot, I mean, the whole plot bottlenecks, you know, into that one location. It's almost like the whole game is kind of building to it. So, and I mean, obviously, it sounds like that was also part of the strategy to make that level have an impact.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we might have overdone it. Like, I worry a little bit in retrospect about people who just wanted a sneaking around the mansions and stealing stuff experience, like forced into their deepest nightmares, which is kind of what we're intending to do to them.
Yeah, well,
Oh well.
I was definitely not one of the people who wanted to sneak more into houses and stuff like that. I definitely wanted the horrible nightmares. So.
Great. Yeah, I think we did. My sense is that we did a better job in Thief 3, providing varied experiences, which were variations on stealth and exploration, and not just like pure stealth. They were sort of trapped in, you know, to per the earlier discussion.
Yeah, I mean, there was plenty of variety too, and I think the open world aspect handled a lot of the just get to steal from rent. Like, if you really wanted to steal from people in their houses, I mean, that was there if you wanted it, and you could just.
Yeah, Thief didn't give you any control over your own pacing, really. I mean, it did a bit because you can be the super slow thief, or you can be the sort of like sprint through thief. But you're basically told what experience to have all the time, on the mid level at least, if not the low level. And you know, we really tried to open that up in Thief 3 and provide, you know, flexibility on the high level. Hey, which mission do you want to go to next? And flexibility in the mid level, like, man, what are you in the mood for? You want to break into somebody's house? Do you want to go explore that graveyard you heard about? Do you want to try to get in good with the hammers? What about the pagans? You can't get in good with both of them. What do you want to do? You know, and obviously on the low level, where the sort of tactical variety in the action gameplay has always been very afforded a lot of flexibility in the Thief series, and we definitely tried to expand and retain that.
So after that, you said that you left before the project was completely over, and was that to go to EA?
No, I was actually fired off the project. So, you know, there's a fair amount of politics and circumstance there. You know, I don't think either myself or the person who fired me or the team has a whole lot of hard feelings about it anymore. It's like, I can kind of understand where that decision came from. I can also understand how it might have been a bad decision. But certainly I wasn't happy on the project anymore. And a lot of it really has to do with production reasons. I mean, I certainly could have been a better creative director and could have had stronger alliances within the studio, but things weren't horrible, but the project was really suffering. The studio, you know, shut down shortly after that, and the studio was suffering, and there was just sort of like a pretty bad vibe, and that wasn't helping me do my best work, isn't helping me be happy. And so ultimately I left.
So did you was the next main thing for you EA after that, or was it?
No, I totally took vacation from the games industry. That's something I've done actually kind of pretty often. Like after Looking Glass closed, it was like several months that I wasn't working or even really trying to work.
Just to kind of like
And
decompress kind of a thing, or
yeah, I mean, I think it's really important as a creative person. So actually what I did after Thief 3 is I traveled around Europe. I moved back to Vermont, which is where I live now. This is where I grew up. Spent a little time there. Then I went into a consultancy career. I wound up consulting with Arcane Studios, Ubisoft, a little bit of Electronic Arts, you know, and that was really interesting to see a bunch of different studios and how they operated, what their strengths and weaknesses and structures were, what their design culture was like, what kind of help and support they needed, and try to help, you know, make an impact on different studios.
Arcane
So that's what I did for a
Studios
while after that. What's that?
was Arcane Studios. Why is that familiar to me? Are they?
Oh, they're right in Austin, Texas, and also Lyon, France. They have two studios. They worked a little bit
Are they
for the
actually?
Elemento project, the Spielberg project in EA. They
Okay.
shipped Arx
Oh, Arx
Fatalis,
Fatalis. That's what.
right?
Yes, that's what. That's
Yeah,
why I know them. Yeah.
and then more recently, Dark Messiah of Might and Magic, which actually has Stephen Russell, the voice actor of Garrett, as the voice actor of the main character.
Oh, he's also in Arx Fatalis, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wait, maybe he's in Arx Fatalis and not Dark Messiah.
Oh, I remember. Yeah, because like anytime I hear him in a game, I'm like, oh my God, it's Garrett.
It's Garrett, yeah.
But yeah, he's also a voice in System Shock 2.
That sounds, yeah, he is.
I think
Yeah.
he's the
Actually, he's in
voice
a
of
few
Garrett.
voices. Well, and then for Thief 2, he's both Garrett and Karrus, who's like the big bad guy leader of the mechanics that you defeat at the end. So he's the hero and he's the hero and the villain.
Oh, you mean that guy who sounds like Elmer Fudd?
That's the one.
I don't mean
I'm not
that.
going to take credit for that particular piece of voice
No,
acting.
I like his character, but he just sound. I mean, he just. I mean, like if Elmer Fudd was like a creepy serial killer or something, you know, like he's like a
And
really disturbing
maybe
character.
it works for people. He's definitely supposed to be a very disturbed character, so that part's
Yeah,
good.
but I remember him having like a lisp or like a really weird way of talking in the game. But yeah, would have no idea it was the same actor.
Yeah, no. Stephen Russell is just an amazing voice
I'm
actor.
sure, yeah.
Incredible range. Yeah.
Cool. So I know that at the beginning of this conversation you mentioned something about extending some of the philosophies that you learned at Looking Glass and how that shaped your overall personal aesthetic of game design and game development and how that's now manifested most recently in stuff like Spider. And I'm wondering if it would be possible to talk about some of the EA stuff, or I don't know if that's like still NDA territory.
Yeah, that's off terms for me at least. I won't be talking about that anytime soon.
Okay.
I mean, I will say that I mean it was a project that involved Steven Spielberg. It also involved Doug Church, who is one of the absolute most key, creative design folks at the Looking Glass. That's one of the reasons I took that project is because I got to work with Doug again. And we sort of brought in bits and pieces of the Looking Glass family over time and sort of got them involved to some degree as well. Austin contributed a bit. Terry Brosius has contributed a bit, and so forth.
That and not talking about it is of course perfectly fine. It does strike me as interesting that when Austin was on the podcast, it just seems interesting to me that you had this kind of philosophy of like let's really think about immersion, let's really get everything out of the way of the player feeling like they're a person in this immersive story world. And then Austin also went to do a Spielberg related project.
Yeah.
And then you did as well, and Doug did as well years later when there was another project. So that's quite interesting to me.
Yeah, I don't really know what to make. I think it might be coincidence.
Well, I'm sure it is, unless there's a puppet master behind everything. Yeah, so after that, you.
I mean, actually, let me speak to that for a second.
Okay.
If I was to guess, I would say that part of why that might be the case is that my impression is that Steven Spielberg actually like really understands the potential of the interactive media. Like, it's not uncommon that you hear people from linear media like film talk about wanting to be involved with games, but really they're not. When they want to make a story for games, they're really imagining a linear story because that's what they're trained on, what they're best at, and that tends to be a complication trying to get them to overcome that understanding and allow the medium of video games to do what they do best interactively, because that's a very different style of narrative structure and storytelling. I'll just leave it at that, storytelling. Whereas my sense is that Steven really appreciates interactivity and understands that that's the fundamental distinct characteristic of our medium and wants to leverage that when he makes works in video games. And I assume that what's been going on is that he talks to people on a high level and he's like, hey, I want to work with your studio. I want to make a game. I'm interested in games like this. And they hear what he says and or just infer it somehow, because I absolutely have never been part of those discussions. And are like, oh, you should be working with guys like this, and kind of winds up getting pointed at us. Now, then again, I believe he was very heavily involved in the Medal of Honor series, which is basically the antithesis of a lot of the
Sure.
design philosophy we've talked about. So he's flexible, certainly. But I would guess that there's some sort of dynamic like that that is part of why, people like Austin and Doug have gotten involved.
Is there, I'm wondering if that's like general as a trend, if that's something that you have any thoughts about, like do you feel like there's a particular thing that like people are getting wrong about it, or like what do you, is there advice
Well,
you would give people, or?
I mean, I think the problem, it's, I don't think the problem with film directors' involvement is different than any other high production video game. I mean, I think if you're a film director who wants to make a game and it wants to be slick because you're trying to expand your reach and your image and your IP, you're going to want a pretty high production game. You're looking at a AAA game, and pretty much any AAA game needs to, be so profitable that people wind up being very risk averse. And I think that is difficult. It's difficult to innovate, you know. And a lot of, like, if you made the movie Commandos or the modern equivalent, and all you want is a guy who runs around shooting, like, we're really gonna be able to do that. That's like one of the things we're great at, and we can do AAA games that totally hit all those beats and fulfill those fantasies. If you want a movie about racing cars, great, we do that. But in practice, films are never just about that. Like, the heart of a film IP is never just a guy who shoots it. Well, maybe it is sometimes. But it's never just the guy who races. You don't have a film where, like, there's a camera behind a race car for 60 minutes. Like, that does not happen, because films tend to be about the human experience in a much more direct to the human psychology way, or maybe indirect from an external audience member, as opposed to you just get to be the character, which is closer to what we do in games. And so most film directors are going to want to hit beats like that. And those are ones we don't really know how to do very well. And so you're trying to do something very innovative in a very high production, expensive, risk-averse capacity. And I think a lot of the times what happens is you wind up boiling the larger, more important messages of your work down to, like, racing and shooting and the other things that video games do well, because that's something that we know that can succeed. So how to make, you know, more innovative gameplay mechanics, how to be better artistically themed. Like, these are things that video games are still working on. You know, there's a set of things we do really well, and there's another set of things that we're trying to understand better, such as interactions with characters, which is one of the mainstays of almost all films. And it's just going to be hard. Like, if there's a piece of advice, it's that to figure out how, you know, who's been doing good innovative design and how they succeed and follow in their footprints. Like, for example, you probably need to prototype in a really low fidelity way for a long time until you found game mechanics that work, and then you can turn on the big fire hose of money in production and make it look pretty, which is probably, like, kind of a counterintuitive way to think for a lot of these projects. Like, you have to show results, you know, and it's hard stuff, I think, is the short answer.
Yeah, it's I'm sure. So then, am I right? Am I correct in thinking that Spider was your the main thing you did after? You left EA?
Yep. As soon as I left EA, pretty much, as I started an indie studio, and we all collaborated and made the game Spider. Yeah. And that game does carry a little bit of Looking Glass mentality. As I said, the other lead of our studio is David Klina, who was actually the AI engineer on both Deus Ex 2, Invisible War, and Thief Deadly Shadows. So I worked pretty closely with him on Thief. And he didn't come from Looking Glass. Actually, previously he worked on the original Splinter Cell with Clint Hawking and that whole team. We actually poached him out of that team, sort of. And, you know, so he definitely has a very similar background and mentality and way of thinking about games that's complementary to mine. And so there's and we even, you know, worked with some other folks like Terry Brocious and people who also come from Looking Glass background. But for the most part, it was a lot of me and David's design work. And Spider is a really simple game. It's a very casual experience. But the things we were trying to do are Looking Glass types of goals. Like, we really wanted it to be an innovative game mechanic. So we found this cool mechanic about building webs and trapping bugs that was, if not absolutely brand new, it's a pretty good newish subgenre of a platforming, you know, genre. Mm-hmm. And so we felt really good about that. And then we really wanted to do environmental storytelling and have some sense of meaning to our work that was more than just a diversion. And unlike Looking Glass, we were trying to really streamline things down, really make them simple and digestible to a casual audience. So our sort of internal slogan is immediacy with depth. So the depth part is very Looking Glass appropriate. Like, once we have this web building mechanic, there's lots and lots of stuff that you can do with it. And we really tried to push the player into exploring all of its dimensions. But it was a very immediate mechanic, and you were never forced to do the sophisticated things. It was okay to have a pretty casual surface level experience, you know. But yeah, we're definitely borrowing from the mentality. It's just sort of part of our DNA.
So it sounds like those are definitely, when you were talking about trying to keep things simple and not make them so complicated, it sounds like that's almost kind of the arc from where you were saying you started on Deadly Shadows, right? By sort of resisting some of that stuff, and then you're really trying to use it well to reach a new audience in something like Spider.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's you know, it's been a career where that particular question about how complicated, how big, how focused versus how focused has come up repeatedly. And so certainly the tack we took with Spider was to really be focused and really get the depth through simplicity and not through complexity. Because it is possible to get depth through simple mechanics, as opposed to always having lots of overlapping complicated mechanics. And so that was the angle we took. And, you know, I think it was very successful. I think we really met the goals that we were trying to meet. And we're really happy with the response and the reception and everything.
You've got awards, right?
Oh, lots and lots of awards. It got the, you know, we're probably most happy about the fact that it got the IGF, the Indie Game Festivals, which is basically, you know, the equivalent of the Game Developer Choice Awards, which is the equivalent of our industry's Oscars or something like that. You know, so for in the indie category, one of the top two awards we were eligible for, mobile game and iPhone game. For last year. So totally, that was the one we were most happy to receive, I think, because getting recognized by your peers for your work is just the greatest thing, you know. So it was very successful, and I think for the second game we're working on now, we're taking a slightly more complicated direction. We don't want to compromise the accessibility and the immediacy. Those are really important goals for us. But we're also trying to make it a bit deeper and allow for a more sophisticated experience. We're really trying to – one of the reasons I was so happy to work on the iPhone is that I wanted to reach an audience of people who owned cell phones, which means everybody, as opposed to people who own Xbox 360s, which implies a certain culture with a certain set of expectations. It really felt to me like the iPhone culture was a lot more open to new things. And if we could figure out to distill them down to their essence, we'd both have an easier time making more games in unit time, and we'd reach more people who were more receptive to it. So that was the theory. Certainly, it's a very ADD market. It's proved difficult to meet those immediacy goals while expanding the depth, but that's the thing we're working on now. Like, we really kind of want to bring these interesting and sophisticated design topics, such as the ones that were inspired by the Looking Glass School of Thought, to a whole new, you know, audience.
So it sounds like you're trying to kind of almost like kind of like a back to square one, and kind of trying to build your way gradually towards something that's reaching more of that complexity that you used to deal with, but making sure you get there built on this foundation of accessibility.
Yeah, that's fair. I don't know if I've ever been at square one. I think square one's hard to get to. You know, it's in some ways it's harder. I don't want to overstate this. It can be harder to design a game like Spider where you don't do everything that you can think of than it is, you know, to build a game where you just throw in every idea. It's certainly more work to implement all those ideas, but there's a certain elegance of design to trying to like narrow it down to something that a five-year-old can get and enjoy, and then your grandmother can get and enjoy. Like, to really reach a wide audience, it can be very challenging.
Sure, that's definitely.
So it's taken some real effort to get to square one, I think. But we did pretty good on our first, you know, shot at the gate, and we're certainly hoping to do as well for the second one.
Yeah, it seems like it. And if I understand it correctly, your company is kind of decentralized, isn't it? I mean, it's not
like we're totally distributed. Like, I'm here in Huntington, Vermont. David's in Austin, Texas. We've got people in Los Angeles, Portland, Washington, D.C., all over.
And that hasn't – it sounds like that's worked out well for you.
Oh, very well, yeah. I mean, more than well. It's, you know, it's a whole business approach of trying to keep our overhead as small as possible and put all of our money into the development.
And is that – how is that I guess I'm wondering is, like, do you have a sense of, like, why that's worked out for you? Is it about good communication? Is it about making sure you have – channels set up for, I mean, like how you do deliverables and builds, or I mean, how does that use Skype a lot? Or
yeah, no, we've totally invested in telecommuting and, you know, the virtual infrastructure and stuff, so that's helpful. I mean, there's a lot of tools out there for this type of thing today. It's really just not that hard to do them, but a lot of it is that we're a small studio and there's a lot of alignment within the studio about what types of things we're working on. It was easier on Spider a little bit because we just knew from the very early beginning what kind of game it was going to be and what we're working on. And this more recent game, we're sort of we've struggled and wandered trying to find the heart of the project, which I think we're closing in on now. But like in the meantime, that wandering I think has been probably not easy for the team to digest all the time and understand what we're working on, what the point was. So it varies, you know. It really, there's been times when I wish we were all in the same room together and we could brainstorm together and draw on a whiteboard. But for the most part, it really hasn't hurt that much. It's a small studio. We communicate well. We have alignment of goals.
Huh. And it sounds like you've been careful to try to recreate that people sort of being, if not on the same page, sort of all in the same ballpark or having a similar mentality. So it's okay to kind of let people come up with their own ideas because you know that the kind of ideas they're going to come up with are not going to be really far away from the vision.
Yeah, that's certainly the goal, is to be able to articulate a creative vision that is a space, and anybody can contribute an idea inside that space, and you can say, like, yeah, that's great. And if they contribute outside the space, you take a moment and you say, Well, here's why I thought that was outside the space, you know, the direction I had in mind. And if they convince you that that's actually a good idea, then you sort of adjust your understanding of the space. And if you convince them, then they have a better understanding of what you're targeting. You know, that's what you're trying to do as a creative director.
That makes a lot of sense. And
I mean, or you can shut everybody down and all their ideas and cram your ideas down their throat. And some people do that too, but I don't find it leads to the best results.
yeah, well, and it seems like you have some good and your the way you were brought into the industry seems to have been built on that kind of process to begin with.
Yeah.
Which is so you had it sounds like you were very fortunate to have that experience and you know, not go to a company where you were smacked down, right,
Yeah, totally.
for having those kind of ideas and then gradually having to kind of, you know, learn how to express them. So
Yep, getting the right creative, you know, collaborative environment, I think, is really important to me, and I find just always leads to really like the best work you can get out of people and yourself. It was a great privilege of my career to be able to start a Looking Glass and absorb the lessons of that culture and those, you know, incredible people who work there, and you know, the friendships I have with them are still ongoing, and it's just awesome to see the impact that they've had in the games industry. Like, they've all sort of splintered out and wound up in different studios, or they've made amazing contributions, like from Fallout 3 to Half-Life 2. You know, Epic Mickey just came out. Like, all kinds of stuff is really come out of that group of people. So it's been pretty awesome.